Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is a guy who's worked for both Herbie Hancock and Prince, who's built tons of studios, and is an author and host of a webcast, Dave Hampton. But first, let's talk about something new that just happened with Google. They've updated their algorithm, and that means that if your website is not mobile-friendly, you're going to get penalized in the search rankings. So basically, if you've built your website on an old protocol and it doesn't look good on a mobile phone, you're going to get dinged pretty badly in search engine results. Because among other things, and apparently there's over 120 things that Google looks at, one new one is if you're search engine ready or not. So how do you tell if you are or not? Well, there's two ways. One quick way is to just call your site up on a browser and then take the browser and move it all the way to the left. In other words, close the window so it goes all the way to the left, as far as it will go. And if you can read what's there, then it's probably mobile ready. If you can't read it and it looks all scrambled, then that's probably not going to work. You're going to get penalized. There's a better way to discover this. Google actually has a tool that you can plug in your URL and it will tell you exactly what the problem is, if there is a problem. And this is at google.com/webmasters/tools/mobile-friendly. And I'll include that down below in the notes. If you call up that site and you put in your website URL, it will analyze it for you and it will tell you, yes, you're good to go. It's mobile friendly. Or the good thing is it will tell you if you're not and it will tell you why, and then it will tell you what to do about it. So Google's actually being pretty good about this. Usually it doesn't take much to actually fix a website unless it's really, really old, in which case you have to update it anyway. Try that out. See if your website is good to go mobile-wise or not. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's called 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Now, we all work with guitars one way or the other. Even if we don't play them, we record them. They're a part of just about every record, and we're talking about electric guitars, not acoustic guitars. You might wonder why guitars sound the way they do. A lot of it has to do with the pickups. Not everything, but a lot. And there's actually 9 different things that determine how a pickup sounds. Okay, number one is the number of windings. So basically what it is this coil of wire that's wound around a bobbin, which has a number of magnets in the middle. And what happens is the more turns of wire around the bobbin, the louder it is, but the less high frequencies. So there's this fine balance of how many turns. Do you want more highs or do you want it louder? That's one thing. The second thing is the type of wire, because it determines the resistance, and that's a big factor in how it's going to sound. Once again, the highs versus how loud it's going to be. The third thing is the type of winding. And in the old days, they used to hand wind. There's a winder that you would get, and basically a person would just wind it. So you'd have 7,000, 8,000, 6,000 turns on a bobbin. The thing about winding it by hand is you get uneven winds. And the good thing about that is it changes the capacitance, which again will change the sound of the pickup. And sometimes you get just a magic sound from it. The way we do it today is there are machines that will wind a pickup very, very precisely, and they're all the same from pickup to pickup. The good thing is they all sound the same, and if you get something that you particularly like, you can always replace it, no problem. The bad thing is there's just not that magic that there used to be because of some lucky winding that happened. Number four is the type of magnets, and just like with speakers, there's different type of magnets that they're built around, Alnico, neodymium, or ceramic, and of course that's going to change the strength, which is going to change the loudness versus, once again, how brilliant they are, what the highs are like. Number five is the strength of the magnets. The stronger the magnet, the louder it is and the brighter it is. Magnets are classified in strength from 2 to 5 on a number scale. And now they're very precise. You either get all 2s, all 3s, all 5s, no problem. But in the old days, they just have a bunch of magnets and someone would reach over and grab a bunch, and they weren't necessarily classified 2 through 5. So once again, you'd get something magic sometimes, and sometimes you get something that wasn't, which is why old vintage guitars, some of them are just magic sounding. They're great. And that's because of all of these irregularities. Sometimes it really works and sometimes it doesn't. Number 6 is magnet height. And of course, the closer to the string, the louder it's going to be. Number 7 is a pickup cover. And you've seen lots and lots of pictures, or you've seen people with instruments that have, especially Gibsons, that have the pickup covers removed. Well, the pickup cover is there for a reason, and that's there to decrease feedback at high volumes. Doesn't do too much at lower volumes, but at high volumes, it makes a big difference. So sometimes people will say, well, get rid of them and it sounds better. It's marginal, but it does make a difference. Number 8 is the pickup potted or not. Potted means, is it dipped into a vat of wax? And there's a reason why they do that. Pickups can be microphonic, meaning that they'll act like a microphone. You can actually talk into them. By potting them, by dipping them in wax, you pretty much eliminate that. And it does change the sound as well. Some people like microphonic pickups. So again, that makes a big difference. Number 9 is, what kind of volume control are you using? The potentiometers, the resistance of the potentiometers makes a big difference. So in other words, the higher the resistance, the more highs you'll get. And just to give you an example, Fender guitars usually use 250K potentiometers, while Gibson uses 500K. And there are some guitar manufacturers that will use up to 1 mega ohm. Again, this will make a big difference. Sometimes you can make a difference in your guitar by just changing the pots. So those are the 9 things that affect guitar pickup sound. The number of windings, the type of wire that's used, the type of winding, the type of magnets, the strength of the magnets, the magnet height, if there's a pickup cover or not, if the pickup is potted or not, and the type of potentiometers that are used. My guest is Dave Hampton. He's about as multifaceted as you can get in the music business. He's built studios and ran the technical operations for some of the biggest stars in the business, including Herbie Hancock and Prince. He's also an engineer, and he's the author of 2 books, and most recently, the host of the Everything Audio webcast, and that's sponsored by Waves. I spoke with Dave from one of his clients' studios in Los Angeles. So Dave, thank you so much for being with me today. I appreciate it. I wanted to have you on for a long time, and now's the day.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
You're a man of many talents, from tech to engineering to being an author to now being a host of a webcast. You do a lot of stuff. But tell me how you got started. What's your first gig in the business?
Wow, my first gig in the business. My first gig in the business was doing 2 things: syndicated radio shows and Armed Forces Radio. Technically, if I want to say what was my first gig, you know, before that I was just a kid who went to tech school, who went to school for electronics, and I was in there just to major in electronics. I was going to do aerospace electronics, and I started to actually. And I had some friends who were going to a local school. They didn't want to do their homework, and they were taking this experimental course called Electronic Music and Recording. They had to take a electronic circuit, and they didn't want to do their homework, so they knew the geek kid that did electronics. So they'd all pay me $5, and I'd do their homework. And one day I went to school with him because I just wanted to see what this thing was I was doing, and I went to a synth class with them. The teacher handed out a block diagram of the ARP 2600, and I just saw it as a sound generator and a block diagram. So I just went right to it and just started programming. And the teacher was like, "Wow, you're really good at this." I'm going, "Well, it's just a signal generator, you know?"
Yeah.
And so everybody's like, "Wow, you should think about coming here." So, you know, I just hung out a little bit more, saw what it was. It looked pretty interesting. So at that time, you could you know, just go in one of 3 or 4 disciplines. And I said, you know what, I'm going to try this electronic music and recording. So I transferred over to the school and started taking electronic music and recording. At a certain point, I really liked it, declared what was called a special major at the time, combined a couple of departments, and came up with a way I could study that and major in that. And then At that time, there were boxes starting to be made in Venice, California, called drum machines and synthesizers out of a company named Oberheim. And they were pulling students from this course to work there. And they pulled a classmate of mine named Marcus Ryle. Then they pulled a classmate of mine named, everybody knows him now, as Cholitos. And he was actually my guidance counselor. And then as those guys moved on and worked through Oberheim and they left to start their own companies and do their own thing, they said, hey, go get this kid named Dave Hampton. So I left, finished school. At that time, I think I had taken a job because I was expecting the first child. And I was working at Hughes, I think, on missile guidance systems. And I got a call that said, hey, would you be interested in coming to work at Oberheim? And I was like really excited because it was what I had been studying, but then I was doing this job that I knew how to do, which is electronics, because I was expecting we were expecting the first child. So I said, you know what? I'm never going to know what happened if I don't take this gig. So I went from making like $12 an hour to making $6.50 an hour, but I never looked back. You know, I didn't, the minute they said, well, we'll offer you $6.50. I said, I'll take it. And never looked back, man. It was good. I spent about 5 years there. And learned a whole lot from Tom Oberheim and all the guys. You know, and this is at during the time where we were all involved in introducing MIDI, you know, with sequential circuits and all these other folks. And a lot of breakthroughs were coming because the microprocessor was entering the controller, you know.
Right, right.
And so my background is heavy analog electronics. My background, you know, when I was in school, I also wrote papers on building. I said, one day you're going to be able to build a studio in your home. So I took my little bit of grant money and I built a studio in my mom's garage. It's still there to this day. And I started doing that. And then I got out of school and the business changed and I ran into a couple of producers who were going to build studios and I gave them a hand. And all of a sudden it turned into something that more and more people were doing. And then it would turn into 2, 3, and then it turned into a lot more because nobody was servicing the people on my side of the town, in my community, in this case in Los Angeles, from San Pedro to Wilshire Boulevard. Nobody was servicing their needs if they wanted to have some kind of a musical setting. You know, it wasn't enough money for them. So yeah. I probably built about 75 studios between San Pedro and Wilshire.
No kidding. I had no idea.
Yeah, because, for churches, for all kinds of organizations, for, you know, some in inner city programs and just a bunch of different places for some for musicians. And then I eventually did a facility for an artist and someone took notice. Mix Magazine did an article on it. And that brought me to the minds of some other people. And then that's slowly how I, all this time I'm still working in the music business, still doing custom electronics. I stayed at Oberheim for about 5 years, but I was also at night programming records, showing people how to work the machines that they would buy. So, you know, from 7 in the morning to 2 in the afternoon, I would be making synthesizers and drum machines. From about 4 in the afternoon to midnight, 1, 2 o'clock, I would be in the studio helping people program for records.
Wow.
So I was cutting my teeth at the same time. But I really liked what I was doing. I really liked the electronics of it. I really liked the fact that you could help people get to what they were trying to do with these instruments that were so new, you know, and I didn't know that it was going to turn into a lot of the things it did. I didn't know I'd meet half the people I met, you know, and gosh, you know, I between touring, doing all kinds of situations, doing orchestra dates, because everybody was using synthesizers, samplers and sound modules to bring in cost effective creation.
Yeah.
And so you were finding a lot of situations where you had one guy doing scores for 2, 3 TV shows, and you had another guy who was one of 3 big synth players for an orchestra. And so, you know, there were a lot of different ways that if you had technical proficiency, you could make money. So I really didn't even let a lot of people know that I could engineer until about 15 years into my career, because I noticed that having a lot of technical knowledge was very scary to a lot of other people in the room. I'd show up to show them how to use a synthesizer or a drum machine. The first question a musician would ask me is, do you play?
Yeah.
Which was code word for, are you here to take my job?
Yeah.
So I kind of just tended to not, I tried to just tended to blend into the room and just try and be as efficient as possible. You know, I never used cards because you remember this was before the internet. And I always did word of mouth, because I believe if somebody would see me or get my number from somebody, then they kind of knew what I did, and it didn't have to be a hunt to find me. It was just, okay, and I could get past some of the things that people do, you know, just to try and engage your services.
See, I had much the same background, because I had a technical background with a degree in electronics and everything, and could do, you know, all that stuff as well. I could do the maintenance and everything, studio maintenance. But I, very early on when I got to California, I thought that I think I either have to be a maintenance guy or I have to be a musician or, you know, engineer or whatever. Because if I get typecast as a maintenance guy, I'm going to stay there forever. I was afraid of that anyway. So I just cut it off. And I didn't tell anybody I had any kind of skills other than doing it for myself.
Right, right. Well, you know, I think it's a choice. You know, for me, I really like what I was doing. I investigated getting into the union, but I felt like for me at the time, I was like, wow, this union thing seems kind of funny. You know, you can't get a job unless you're in the union. You can't be in the union unless you have a job.
Exactly right. So still like that.
Wow. And yeah, and then they say, well, you really want to get in, you got to go empty trash cans. I'm going like, okay, 2 years of trade school for electronics. I've worked for IBM, I've worked for Hughes. And then I go for electronic music recording. I've worked at Oberheim. And now I need to ask somebody to empty trash cans.
Yeah.
I'm going like, you know, I think there's another way. I think there might be another way. So I kind of held out for, you know, I don't know what it is, but I know that I'm not going to try that. I'm going to try some of these other things. And I would just try and farm the work that was coming to me on that side of town. And eventually it got me across Wilshire. You know, for anybody in your audience who doesn't know what Wilshire is, Wilshire is a big street in Los Angeles. And then for me, I'm from the inner city of Los Angeles. So to all of us growing up, Wilshire Boulevard was the separating line between, you know, where you lived and the big time and Hollywood and everything else. So the minute you went beyond Wilshire, that was like a big deal. So, you know, it was needless to say, you know, it took a little while, but it, like I said, I really liked what I was doing. I just kept my head down. You know, when I first started, my biggest desire was that my phone ring every day with some work. And I'm fortunate my phone has rung every day, you know, and still does. And you know, I in the beginning, there was no structure because they didn't really teach you how to be an entrepreneur. You just had to do business, doing DBA, do business ads, you know, and eventually that took off and you just kind of wrap it around. You figure out how to do more and more. And, you know, like I said, my first real gig, yeah, I was doing Armed Forces Radio and I was doing syndicated radio shows like Music of the City. And they would prepackage radio shows for certain markets. So let's say for down south, they wanted a 9-part series about the blues, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then we would bring in some celebrity voices. They would read the script. I'd record them. Then we'd backbed it with some music. And this time when you did radio shows, the inevitable thing that would happen is you would print a record. And then in syndication, that record was sent to the local radio station. Once they bought the show, that set of records was sent to the radio station, and that was what they rolled at the radio station when they ran the specials. So we were involved in the recording process, but we were actually doing radio shows, you know, and Armed Forces Radio was the same way. You know, you had tones at the top and you have Armed Forces Radio DJ comes in, does the in and out of the songs, and you record the songs for a certain length. The end of the thing, it has a tone. You know, you just have certain things you have to do for the requirement, but it was engineering and it was audio, and I loved it, man. You know, I was a different kind of kid, man. I really used to get off on all the things that happened in the background. You know, if I went to a concert, I had more fun watching the set change than I did the show sometimes, because I loved how when the lights would come up, they'd take all the opening act stuff off and then they'd go, you know, get ready for the main show, and I'm like, oh man, look at that, you know. And And so I've just always been that kind of person who was fascinated with the support role. And I think it's very important, man. I think, you know, to this day, I love it. You know, I think that ability to serve has gotten me more opportunities than I think anything else.
Well, you know? How did you get the job with Herbie? How did that come about?
Through Mix Magazine. I think I did, it was either Mix or EQ. I did a studio for Babyface. I rebuilt the original ABC Dunhill Studios for Babyface and his wife at that time. And they did an article on it, and one of the people who worked with Herbie read it, and they wanted to make changes. He had just gotten a new console. They wanted to make changes in the control room. And after I finished the studio for Faith, they'd asked me to stay on for a couple of years and manage it. So I did that, and then I got a call, and they said, yeah, Herbie Hancock wants to meet with you. So I was like, boom, I was out the door. You know, but most of the people who there were so young, they didn't know who Herbie Hancock was. And these are some of the writers now. Babyface, of course, who he was. But a lot of the writers and the people I was working with on a daily basis, they didn't realize who he was. And to me, he was a figure from my childhood, because when I was growing up, my dad had a really big jazz record collection. And Saturdays, when we had to do chores, he would pull out Miles Davis and Herbie Hancock records.
Wow. Right? Yeah.
And you had chores, and you had about six chores you had to do, and he would start the record. And as you completed each chore, you had to mark off where you were. So I listened to his music all throughout my childhood on Saturday afternoon. You know.
Wow.
And so without even knowing it, because my father died when I was 19, but without even knowing it, he trained me for the two jobs that I do now, one of which was 12 years I was with Herbie. But now today, the other thing I do is I work very closely with the estate of Miles Davis.
Yeah, right.
So it's very interesting, you know, just some of those things that happen. But yeah, we didn't have any TV. We didn't have any kind of entertainment in our house. All we had was a record player. We didn't even have furniture in the front room, but my dad had a ton of jazz records.
I love it. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, tell me, how did Herbie work, or how does he work? And he has the best musicians. Mm-hmm. All the time. And I'm just wondering, so is there a lot of overdubs or sweetening when he works, or is it just like normal jazz records where they play it down?
You know, for and this is some time because I'm removed from there. You know, coincidentally, the guy who got me into college took my place when I left in 2005 to work with Prince. My best friend from college took my place, and he's with Herbie today.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, when it comes to a lot of stuff we did, he's very spontaneous. He's very, you know, do we do overdubs? Yeah, we did some, but it would take a lot. A lot of times it was just, depending upon what it was, piano stuff, it really didn't take that long. It really is just about the right setting. Mm-hmm. And making sure everything was right from start to finish. That used to really amaze me too, especially working with him and Wayne. We did like 1+1 right at the house, and we recorded that whole record at the house. And some of the things that they would do, just the two of them, is really just so intuitive, because they musically, they know each other so well that you're just a fly on the wall, man. You know, that's the first thing you learn is hit record. You know, just hit record, just get everything. Just wow. Get everything, you know, because you never know when it'll happen. But a lot of the other stuff, doing film and doing some of the other stuff, he's just very spontaneous, man. Just and he's very generous, you know, depending upon the configuration. He knows who he's playing with. He knows how to play to them, with them, and around them. If it's a singer, he knows how to play around the singer and really hug them up and accentuate what's going on. You know, I think that's why on Possibilities, you know, we came back. I flew back from working with Prince to work with some of the guys on the one song for Christina that we did at the house. And that was the one song off of Possibilities that actually, I think it did something, got a nomination or something. But it was just one of those things. He really understands so intuitively how to switch it on. And in turn, he picks the right musicians to play with him. And so what it does is he knows how to make use of everybody. But I like the non-musical communication. That's what I learned. If there's any one thing I learned from Irby, it was non-musical communication.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny. It's funny because it's so important, and especially young musicians, they don't understand that. It takes either you have it or you never understand it, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I had to adapt my skill set because I was not a player. You know, at the time I took my classes in college, they used to require us to do sight reading and to play.
Yeah.
And for me, who was technically proficient, but I was not a musician per se, I had to learn some of these things. But later on down the line, you know, and I speak to you now from the home of a great orchestrator named Benjamin Wright. When I'm doing a session for something like a Justin Timberlake record and he pulls out a chart and puts it in front of the mixing console, I'm so glad I was required to do these classes.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because as I go throughout the country sometimes and look at music schools with recording flow programs, I always notice that when you have a recording program and it's closely attached to a music school, you have a very, very good kindred relationship between the two things. Everybody understands each discipline. When you have recording programs that are out in the open and sometimes they're not necessarily attached to music programs, sometimes you find a lot of disconnect. And I really think that the two go, they just go hand in hand. It helps you so much to understand and look up from learning Pro Tools and all these other things and watch people integrate with one another when they start to play their instrument. Because if you don't learn how to look at people as an engineer and watch when the non-musical cues happen, when somebody's just feeling what somebody else is playing, you know, but you got to look and see. Don't look at what they're playing as far as their hands. You need to look at their face.
You need to
look at their feet, you know. And then all these things we learn, and we learn it in the studio, because when we go live, and I mix live too, you need those as cues when you're in the back of house focusing on your band and you're, you know, 150, 200 feet away, mixing front of house. But you need to know when it's going to happen. And if you think you see it versus no, you see it, you got to learn your players, you know. And in Herbie's case, you know, depending upon what kind of music we do, at that time, we had different lists that we pulled from for, yeah, let's use this combination, you know, and he would just ask for it, yeah.
How did you get the gig with Prince?
One of the things that Herbie allowed me to do when I started working with him, the thing I noticed, most of the guys who work with Herbie, they would always take a salary, and for me, I was like, you know, I enjoyed my freedom of being an independent, so he and I just always worked as an independent. I said, look, as long as I'm doing something, I'll charge you, you know, but if I'm not doing nothing, then you're not going to charge me. So that was just our relationship. And so if I had something else to do, I had the freedom to come and go and do the things I needed to do. And there was a project that CBS was doing, geez, I guess about 1997. Yeah, but I guess 96, 97, they were doing it, and it was a young man. They were going to blow him up into an artist, and they said, we're going to use you, myself, and a guy named Daryl Diaz, who also worked with Herbie. We're going to call you guys to New York, and you're going to work with this guy. Well, the guy ended up being a musician named Maxwell, an artist from CBS named Maxwell. So we worked on the first two records, worked on tours. But when you work on tours, you work with a lot of people. A lot of people in Maxwell's band were former Prince people. So they were all, oh, man, you know, great working with you. Hope to see you again. And some of the band members were like, man, you'd be real good to work with Prince. You should go work with Prince. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I said, man, I'm about, you know, 40, 41, 42 years old. I don't know if I really need to Prince experience, but I'm cool, man. You know, I appreciate it, you know, and I'll go, you know, I heard all kinds of stories about him. I enjoyed his music, but, you know, for me, I had been working with jazz guys.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed what we were doing with CBS because it was like working with guys like Leon Ware and Wawa Watson. And, you know, we were really building something good for a nice young artist. And we left the tour, and then I got a call New Year's night in 2004, New Year's night, I got a call from the front of house engineer for Max, and he says, man, you're going to get a call in 5 minutes. It's going to be Prince. And, you know, I gave him your name, da, 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 da. And I'm like, I'm half asleep. I'm like, yeah, Scotty, right. Now, it's been like 4 years since I talked to him. Right?
Yeah.
So I just thought he was messing around. And you know, the phone rings. And then, yeah, what would it take for you to come over here? I just need to talk to you about doing some stuff in the studio. We're having some problems. And I said, yeah, okay, Scotty. You know, and I said something crazy. I said a crazy price and some crazy terms. I said, okay, somebody will contact you tomorrow. Boom. Phone rings again. It's Scotty. Okay, man, did he call you? I said, yeah, Scotty, I just talked to you. I said, that was a real good imitation. Yeah. So he said, man, he said, dude, that wasn't me. You know, he said, that was him. You know, I said, oh, okay. I'm like, oh, that feel like, I feel crazy now. So, you know, turns out it was him. You know, they picked me up. I flew out there, you know, and the first person I called after I realized what had happened, I called Herbie. I said, listen, Herbie, we're about to start possibilities. I just got the craziest call, man. I said, I got a call to come to Minneapolis and just talk to Prince. He just want to talk. I said, you know, I know we're getting ready to start this. I said, it's not going to be long. I'm just going to fly out, fly right back, and I'll be right back. It won't get in the way. He goes, man. I said, should I go? He goes, man, should you go? He said, I'd go. So I said, okay, well, if I got the okay from you, I would go. So I went at his encouragement, and the rest is kind of history. You know, it's kind of like a slow motion thing. You know, I met him in the middle of the night, and you know, I'm from California, so I'd never seen snow drifts as high as the building, right? I'd never seen doors snowed in to where you had to drive and the snow plow came and plowed it. I've seen pictures, but I've never seen it really like that. So when I got there, everything was dark, and then I see this guy dressed all in black gloves on, coming out of the darkness, extends his hand, hey, how you doing? He goes, follow me, and then we walk back, and of course, I was following down this long hallway, and I could see the light at the end, but my eyes were still adjusting. I'm like, hold on now. know, I'm just trying to make sure that I can get to where I go without tripping on something, you know. And again, I went to talk, so I didn't bring any tools.
Yeah.
So he takes me into the studio. We start to look at the vintage API as custom Domitio. And he says, yeah, I'm having a lot of problems. This stuff has been up. We've got a couple other rooms that are broken. But he said, here's what I want to do. And so he said, let me just show you something. So he goes to play something for me to hear some problems. And when he does, the console goes pop and smoke comes from the console. Now, I did not bring tools. I didn't bring meter. I just came to talk. Right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, do you have a tech room here? Because at that point, I'm like, okay, I can either not do anything and look really crazy, or I can try and affect change. And so I said, well, do you have a tech room here? He said, yeah. He said, we have a tech room. So he had a guy show me the tech room. Well, the place had been closed up for a little while. All of the two rooms weren't functioning. And every time something broke, they had put it in this room they called the tech shop. And so you couldn't get to any tools because the room was just full of tape machines and everything else. So we got those things out of the way. I went in and found the meter, found some tools, and I got underneath and started looking. And I'm like, okay, I can found this. I said, okay. And I'm sitting underneath the board. And then off to the side, I can hear people talking. I hear somebody coming to the studio. And I heard a voice that sounded familiar to me. And I said, man, that sounds like Larry Graham. And he goes, that sounds like Dave Hampton. I said, yeah, it is, Larry. I'm down here. He said, okay, well, then you ain't got nothing to worry about. You know, that he calls Prince little brother. He said, little brother, everything's going to be fine. So I got the console to start, figured out what was going on, and said, okay, here's what's happening. And after that, everything was cool. And we just, you know, slowly created a plan to bring Paisley up to date. So the idea was to fix the problems initially in the two studios that existed. And the other thing was to bring it up to date and make sure that it could support the activity that was going on then and in the future. And so one of the things a lot of people don't know is that a lot of stars who are stars now would come and visit Prince because he would see or hear about them, and he would invite them to kind of see what they're all about.
Yeah.
One of the things that was happening was that the younger stars who were coming, you know, your Alicia Keys and some of the other people, they're come from a different time. So a lot of them did not develop in the large format studio.
Yeah.
Right? They developed in rooms that were probably half the size, using DAW, using some other things. And so as I started to work with him and see the tools that he preferred, I started to get a feel for designing an environment that he could meet them halfway in. So we created a series of smaller rooms that didn't exist. And the whole purpose of the smaller room was that you could go in there with an up-and-coming person and exchange with them, and they wouldn't become intimidated by I'm sitting here with Prince Factor, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then he, in turn, could go in there, create, and when he wanted to do something, he could just turn to a window or grab a control, and instantly he would be on a 2-inch machine because he really enjoys analog. He's really like recording on 2-inch. So everything I did, I kind of freaked out so we had a 2-inch accessible in every situation so that you don't have to bring somebody into the main room and it turn into this spectacle. Sometimes it doesn't need to be a spectacle. And you know, what a budding person who has talent, like who is not Prince, looks entirely different than Prince. So, and you know what I mean? So you have to kind of create a garden that will kind of grow many flowers as opposed to, I'm just going to grow this one flower, you know?
Yeah. Right.
And because with Prince, you know, my challenge there was that you realize I'm coming from Herbie Hancock. So I'm going, man, you know, I know what it takes with Herbie. We're technologically ahead of everybody else because that's what he asked for. He said, I got to be first, whatever it is. So you stay out there and figure out what's ahead of the game, and we're always going to be ahead of the curve. So that was the task. Well, yeah. I thought because I was going to a pop situation that, oh, man, this guy probably is flying the shuttle because I've been doing it in jazz budget, you know.
Yeah.
I got there and it was like a total juxtaposition because he was actually steeped in analog and it was actually everything I started in. And it was like, wow, this is cool because this guy's tapping most of the stuff that I know. And that was my biggest complaint when I went to work with people and they weren't Herbie, is that nobody's tapping a third of what I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I really felt like, man, I wish somebody would tap what I know. And man, Minneapolis was that and more. And so it tapped what I knew, and we had a real good relationship and still do. And I got much respect for him. Now I understand all the stories that I hear people saying, you know, that wasn't my experience. He had a great respect for myself and the crew that we brought in there and everything that we did to bring about the changes. When I got there, it was one room working. Paisley was originally two studios. A soundstage. When we left, it was two large studios, three small studios, a video edit suite, a seamstress shop to make all the clothes, a hair parlor to do the hair, rehearsal stage, as well as the main area, which is about as big as an airplane hangar.
Wow, it's huge.
It's a pretty big place. It's a pretty big place, and it's a big responsibility, but I really enjoyed it. You know, part of the agreement for me was that, you know, I worked in secret, and I didn't mind that at all because, you know, when I probably worked there for about a year and a half before the industry knew that I was working with him. Yeah. And that was the best thing that he and I could have ever kind of dreamed up because I had implemented most of the changes by the time the outside world had figured out what was going on. And then you don't have everybody trying to poo-poo what you're doing and give opinions.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think the biggest thing that happens is everybody wants to look and see what's going on and they want to act like they're the most smartest. And, well, I think this and I think this. And we weren't thinking about anything. I was just going about filling the place with the tools that he asked for and needed, but not doing it in a way that was anything but efficient. And so I think it was better in the long run because then he could just come in, create. And that was the whole idea, to come in and create and do what we need to do. I mean, the other thing is I had a really good team. I had picked engineers who were from different disciplines. So I had a Motown guy there. I had a guy there who was steeped in hip hop and done a lot of Tupac records. And I had my longtime friend, Khalid Glover, there for data as well as for the stuff that he is done in particular with high profile artists, you know.
Yeah.
I just wanted a full palette for him to choose from. And we had some really good young engineers that were there too, who were from the Minneapolis area. And I wanted them because they were familiar with the sound and the pace of the community. And they were familiar with the history.
Yeah.
You know, to me, history is a big thing. And coming from somewhere, especially 12 years of Herbie, the one thing I understood about my career is that I don't know why I'm placed where I'm placed. I don't know how it happens, but when I'm there, I'm there. And usually these people, you know, you're when you're an engineer, you're responsible for history if you're fortunate enough to work with some of these people. So for that moment in time, you have a big responsibility. You have a big responsibility because everything you do is part of a record that you were here and they were here at the same time. And usually the work that they've done, their catalog, whatever, it's impactful to a mass number of people. And so for the time that you are a person's engineer, technical assistant, whatever you want to call the title, it's a very serious thing. It is nothing to take for granted and realize that most of these people they don't have to work again. The royalty stream from a lot of their hit music is such that they really don't, if they want to stop tomorrow, they'd be okay. Okay?
Yeah.
So when they have a studio, that studio isn't for them. It's for you. You know, when I looked at what I was working with at Herbie's, when I got to other places, I realized, you know what? Herbie's so smart. He built this studio, but he didn't build it for himself. He built it for everybody around him.
Yeah.
You know, he built it for Brian Bell in the beginning when he started. He built it for the next guy who came along after Brian. He built it for me for my 12 years, and now he built it for Brian McCullough, who's there now. He built that place so that we got better. And that's any of them. Prince, Paisley Park, that was there for me to get better. It was there for everybody on the team to get better. And so I look at it as these guys are make sacrifices, man, in big ways, in big ways.
Well, speaking of which, this is a good time to go to this. You're an author now with two books under your belt. The Business of Audio Engineering, and so you're an audio engineer, and it's basically you giving the tips that you've learned throughout your career, which are really important. And like you were saying, when you first started, when we all first started, we were independent contractors, we still are, but knowing the business was not something that was important back then, but it's more important than ever right now. So the fact that you're giving that back is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, it is. I mean, especially after sitting with you in this conversation we had yesterday, you know, more so than ever, because the engineer's role is so strategic. And I always felt that before I wrote the books, I was like, wow, I looked at the career and I said, well, there's really no structure where we could go. As always, you get us in the room, everybody will talk about wanting the union and wanting this and wanting that. But realistically, we were given away as a career. Engineers were treated like the toolkit in the Mercedes, right?
Yeah.
When you buy a Mercedes, you get a toolkit in the back for free. So were you in a large format studio, you got an engineer when you rented the room.
Yeah.
So how do you graduate from being the free toolkit to being a specialty tool, to being a power drill, you know? There's got to be some kind of way that you do that. And so as I started to look at it, I'm going like, wow, if we don't change our own direction, we're all in trouble, because the way that we've introduced this technology, it's going to displace us before it embraces us. And if we're just thinking small-minded on the level of songs and this and that, you know, we're forever more doomed. We can't think that small. You know, by virtue of how long we stay here and relevant and working in the business, it requires us every year, Bobby, you, myself, anybody else, to be more creative and complex in our approach to what I hate the term, but they use it all the time, reinventing yourself. People would always say, Dave, you reinvent yourself so well. And I'm going like, I'm not reinventing myself. There was nothing wrong with the first invention, I think. I just choose to do, and I don't really consider myself a mixer or a this or a that. I consider myself a working audio engineer. And my definition of that is that every day my phone rings, I have work, and it is something to do with audio engineering. whether it is installing a Euphonics like I'm doing today, or whether it is fixing somebody's problems in the control room, or whether it is working on my own line of custom speakers, or whether it is writing a book or doing a lecture or interviewing somebody on the show. It all has to do with audio engineering, and you know, we eat, sleep, and breathe this. And I think, you know, that's part of that passion that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
You know, but for us, it exercises itself in a different way. And my goal has always been to not be the people that I work with. You know, when I'm working with Prince, I don't want to be Prince. Mm-hmm. I get a kick out of him being Prince so well that everybody is just floored. I get a kick out of people seeing Herbie and understanding that he is something to behold. Not because of me, but because of the work that we all do to make possible that moment for everybody to see music. When you can help somebody who already has a platform and you could just give them an assist and it's like, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. Man, I can't tell you the many things that Herbie would just take us to for us to experience because he already understood he was depositing something in our bank of life to make sure that we had. He was making sure I had the tools I had for Prince.
Yeah,
right. That's the way I look at it. He was depositing things. He would take us places, and we would go, man, why are we here? He goes, man, you got to shut up. You need to be here. You know, you know, it turned out he was taking us to the TED conference, right?
Yeah.
And so we were like, wow, this is cool, you know. But for us, we were thinking, why? Because we were thinking in terms of a gig or in terms of a concert and, you know, 70-minute show. And it's so one-dimensional. It's like he's taking us on a ride to understand the entry pass that music gives you an opportunity to exercise.
Yeah.
Which makes you a citizen of the world. And so, man, once you see that, you understand what your role is and you really learn to play your role. And so I really enjoyed. I mean, when I first started working with Prince, somebody gave me something that to this day I really appreciate and use. And what they told me is that they said, you know what, if you really focus and do what he asked you to do and do it well, when he wins, his music wins. And I that was my credo as long as I work with him. It's like, when he wins, music wins. So when I go to work with him and we do something, I'm not doing it for the glory of him. I'm doing it so that people can have the experience of seeing music. You know, there's very few people I've been able to work with, and I count them on one hand, where when you're behind the console and you're looking in and watching what's going down, or you're in front of the house and you're mixing, you actually get to see music.
Yeah, right.
And I know you know what I mean.
I do. You know, it's funny. I have one Prince story.
What's that?
I was working at Sunset Sound, mm-hmm. and Prince was in one of the other rooms. I think I was in Studio 2. And there's a basketball court out in back. So we take a break, and I go back, and I go out, and Prince is out there playing basketball by himself. And I thought to mm-hmm. myself, oh, I'd like to shoot some baskets with Prince. This is in the 80s now. This is before he blew up really big.
He thought you could whoop him.
well, I just wanted to play with him, you know. So I get about 10 steps towards him, and out of nowhere, this huge, gigantic guy stood in front of me and kind of like the Jolly Green Giant, you know, and he looked at me and he said, Prince don't want no company. I said, okay, I guess he wants to shoot by himself. So
yeah.
I never did get a chance to meet him. And I thought, you know, in the time I spent at Sunset while he was there, that we'd run into one another, but it never happened. He was definitely, even then, he wanted to stay by himself. So
Yeah, you know, there's a different time. He was a different guy. That was Big Chick that you saw. And those are the early years, you know. Yeah. I think that who I met at 44, when I was 44 years old, he and I were in the right place and time in both our lives to be really productive together.
Yeah.
Because I was in the don't take no shit phase of my career.
Yeah.
I really was very content to work out my days working with guys like Wayne, Hervey, Marcus Miller. And I really enjoyed that jazz thing. I really enjoyed all that stuff. And you know, it was such a challenge. It was what I wanted, you know. That one experience gave me so many confirmations in my life. I have a 7-year-old daughter, right?
Yeah.
And I can never look at that experience as anything but what it was supposed to be. Because if I would have not have gone to Minnesota, I would not have my 7-year-old daughter.
Amazing, so, huh? It's funny how those things that you don't expect turn into big life.
Oh, big life like, moments.
Moments,
yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, big life.
I don't want to keep you too long here, and
I'm cool. Mm.
But I do want to hit a couple other things. Yeah. Reftone.
Yeah.
How did that come about? And for those listening, Reftone is a new version of the Aritone, which we loved so dearly and hated so dearly at the same time back in the 60s and 70s. How did that come about?
Well, it came about because I was doing a lot of custom rooms, some for artists who had a lot of success, and they had a lot of success when there was limited selection in gear, some of which who were leaned on Auratones. They would go to the studio, they'd work with somebody, they'd see some Auratones and some NS10s. So when they built their home studio, they had Auratones and NS10s. Well, Auratone went out of business. I think the guy died. The family didn't want to continue the thing. So a lot of people still use Auratones, but they use replacement drivers, or the body of it was so cheap it would eventually fall apart. But I was going around in publicizing the book, and I was visiting colleges. And since the advent of teaching engineering and Pro Tools came about, I was noticing, as I started to work with younger engineers, there are some reference things that they were not aware of until they came to work with certain of us who are from that era. The two things I noticed is that they were not being taught mono referencing in a structured way.
Mm-hmm.
They were not being taught low volume monitoring for placement and accuracy. They were not being taught specifically the relationship that we have in decision making to the mid range. So those three things made me go, you know what? And the fact that I said, you know what? I'm not getting any younger. I was back from, Minnesota, and I said, you know what? I got a kid. She's going to start school in a little bit. Let me get all my ideas out of my head. And so I built some prototypes, and I sent some to some schools that were teaching people about audio, and I sent some to, the students didn't know that much, and then I sent some to some broadcast people who knew everything about audio.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, do me a favor, make some decisions with these and tell me what you think. Just put them here and just see if you're happy. And I got feedback, you know, made some changes. I gave some to a couple mastering guys, a couple mixers I gave some to, and I got feedback, all the things I need to tweak it up. And then we made some changes on sound testing and the drivers. And, you know, my focus had been on designing something that could be put into a situation, be it laptop service, school, broadcast booths. And it was not designed to be super pricey. It was designed to fill a need, which is I need a way to make my mid-range decision. Because I'm doing this kind of work, and we were in use all over the place. We're in use in broadcast booths. They use us exclusively over at YouTube facility. They use us at Jimmy Kimmel's show. They use us at Tonight Show when they were on. They use us. They use us Letterman, a couple other places, because these guys are all broadcasting music, and they need a way to make sure that the broadcast transmission is cool. They also need a way to discover poor compression. With the advent of plugins, we have a lot of people who have poor compression habits. So as a result, if you use some hype monitors, and I'm not going to mention the two brands, but those two brands in particular keep our brand in business because they're a big choice because they're very hype monitors. They make everything you play sound good. Unfortunately, they mask the poor compression. So if you're monitoring through those on the broadcast line, you will let through some bad compression unless you're able to check it. So we're in use there. And, you know, it just turned out to be a winner. And again, it's a, we kept to the paper driver principle, but we spent a lot of time on the enclosure. So much the same way if you bought a custom Augsburger and you get a Baltic birch enclosure, you know, our yeah. first prototypes that we did out here were all Baltic birch and fully enclosed and machined. And we've also done some upline. We do a custom line that's you know, for mastering guys, and we do match grain walnut, match grain oak, and things like that. But for the most part, we have a really cool enclosure that we've worked on and a really nice paper driver that gives us an extra extrusion for the way music is created today. The original speaker that you speak of, they built that at a time when music was more acoustic. And today, within the last 15 years, music has undergone a change, and a lot of the things that generate the sound are artificial. They're, you know, wave tables and partials and all these other things, which does a different amount of wear and tear on a driver because the signal being generated is not necessarily acoustic, but it is nevertheless going to fatigue your driver a different way because it's being generated now. So we had to take all that in mind and kind of do it. So that's kind of where we're at. And, you know, a list price of $299 a pair, and you know, they're available all over, but we, you know, they're out there. And
are they powered?
No, they're not powered. They're passive because I wanted to give people the option to understand the signal flow and the chain. If you go to our website, we have suggested amplifiers. So if you want something, if you're in the studio and you want to power them with your Brysons, you can. You want to power them with your Crowns, you can. We give you the call out. But if you want to take them on the road, we've got some out, and with all the shows, like in Vegas, Mariah Carey's, people use them. We've got them out with a couple of sound companies and all their guys who are doing playback and doing any kind of stuff. They're using them too. You know, so it's, and they have small amplifiers that they carry. We have music directors who use them. They take it back to the hotel. They can make some quick edits.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times when you're doing live shows and you're using samples or tracks or stems, you're dealing with dry files, right?
Yeah.
So you need to make an adjustment on a dry file. You need something that's going to give you, again, that mid-range, because when you're dealing with audio playback for live performance, you're dealing with accelerated volume level of material. So you're trying to get clarity over volume,
yeah,
because you're playing back in a hockey arena or, you know, you're trying to get these things achieved. Well, it starts with your core decision-making tools. And again, that mid-range is such an important area for all of us that we have to look at, you know, and the reason why I did what I did is because going to the schools allowed me to look at how people learn now. And people learn differently now. So they feel, a lot of young engineers feel that Pro Tools is audio.
Yeah, right,
and
right.
So and they'll operate with a very demonstrative attitude, like they know it all because they know all of Pro Tools. And it goes way beyond that. But how do you make somebody who thinks they know it all understand that they need to know a little bit more? Well, you can't get into a fight with them, but just give them some tools that they can use and just allow them to back up into the end zone and get the touchdown on their own. Just, you know, let them pick up a fumble. You know?
Well, you know, speaking of which, so you're the host of Everything Audio, the web show that's sponsored by Waves, and you have that mm-hmm. same approach where mm-hmm. you're trying to bring your audience along, not only inform them and keep them up to date, but bring them along. And you're not talking down to them. That's the great thing. You've had some really great guests, and I was one of them, you know, actually yesterday. And thank you for that. I appreciate it. But I got to say, it's very cool. It's a great production. You do a great job. And I'm curious how it came about.
Wow. I have known Waves for a long time, since I was working with Herbie. They've always been real cool. I've known Nick and Galad for a long time, and they've always been very cool and respectful, and just, you know, I wanted to see everybody do well. And when I was working at Herbie's, one of the things that he taught us was that, you know, when it came to gear, he didn't want to use any gear just because somebody was giving it to him. So we would buy a lot of stuff rather than try and go through this. But if we really liked it, we just would have a relationship with the company because the stuff worked.
Yeah.
You know, and so we you got to support the industry, you know. And so, you know, through the years, we just always stayed in touch. When Nick would have a product, sometimes he would say, man, I want you to see something. Or Galab would say, hey, take a look at this. And, you know, I would just write him an email on what I thought. And, you know, a couple times they would take my suggestions and they, you know, I guess they would counsel with it, and, you know, it would help them to do some things. But I've known Mick a long time, and he's just a very consistent person in the business. He's one of the executives at Wave. And he asked me a couple of years ago, hey, would you guys think about doing a show? You know, and it would just be a show. We would do this. The idea is to do this, this, and this. And I said, you know, I said, you sure you don't want somebody younger? You sure you don't want somebody prettier? You know, you sure you don't, you know, because I'm well aware of communication and everything. And he said, no, I want you to do it. You know, we'll see what happens. So, you know, long story short, we messed around with it, came up with some stuff. And then I had a friend of mine who was working previously at another place, and he ended up working over at YouTube facility. And I said, you know, he just showed me this place. I think it would be a real good situation for us to look at. And we went over there and saw the YouTube studios and created a way to work there, and started shooting the show from there. And, you know, the idea behind the show was that to take some of the things and some of the attitude that I had learned from my time with Herbie, and to basically try and give people a mindset to think about that will help them survive the changes.
Yeah.
Because honestly, if I just wanted to focus on engineering, there's already a show. Pensado does that well. They talk about mixing, they talk about all that, and I think that's a good direction. But if they're already covering it, I think it's better for us to talk about something.
Well, it's more global.
Yeah, a little bit more global and a little bit more far-reaching, because times are changing. And the way that I survived the industry was by being able to look ahead and be part of that change. So I just want to give people a view to looking at all things where audio interacts and connects. And so through Mick and Galad and the team at Waves and myself, we came up with some directions. And, you know, we just finished, you know, about the third or fourth show. But each time we pair the guests together, we try and put it together so that the audience, and our audience ranges from all kinds of users. So we're not trying to talk over people's heads. But we also know that, you know, our audience is not, you know, they're not silly. They really know what they want to do. And a lot of times they use the product. So it's not necessarily a product push. You can go on to the YouTube channel and you can learn about any Waves product you want, because they got great videos. This is more about getting inside the head of creative at all different levels. Not only people in front of the mic, people behind the mic, but just to see that there are some different careers, there's some different mindsets, to understand that for all of us to be relevant, we got to really understand who uses audio and where it comes into play, and that there's some commonalities. So we don't want to, you know, when you read articles and you see, oh, the recording business is this and this business is this, and we're all in trouble, it's dying. And, you know, those are all things that people are saying. But, you know, Bobby, your phone's still ringing and my phone's still ringing, so I don't know what's dying that they're writing about.
Well,
and, you know.
This is actually a good time for this. Last question for you. What's the best piece of business advice that you've either learned through your years or that you received from somebody?
Herbie gave me one lesson that was really good. And that was, I used to make all kinds of plans. He would like to experiment with different new things. My fear as a technical person was that the thing would not work, or it would break at some point, because we were using it at such a young stage of its development. So I would always have a plan B when we went to use something new. So we were going to do a keynote speech for, I believe it was AES. And I had this intricate plan that I had worked up, because we were using, Logic was rewriting software every night for us to do something during the demonstration that hadn't been done yet. And we were going through every night, we get a new version. I'm like, man, if this doesn't work, we gotta we got to make this happen. We gotta. So I had all this intricate stuff worked out. And probably about the third revision of software, he's like, Dave, he said, why don't you just plan on it working? So I'm like, okay, at that point, I put all my plan Bs away, and I just focused on that, supporting what was going to happen and it working, and everything worked. But ever since then, I don't put all that energy into that secondary plan. I understood what you said, just told me to commit.
Yeah,
you know, just like he would tell a musician, commit to plan. He was telling me, commit to what you're doing and make sure that, you know, you get it done. So that, you know, I really learned a valuable one there. I learned another one, which is that some kind of money costs too much to make.
that's a great
that's
one.
That's one that I pass on to a lot of people, because a lot of times, you know, you have to measure how you give of yourself. In the situation, you know, when I started, I would do anything because it was work and I loved what I was doing. You know, I'm well into this. And so when I do something now, it's because I choose to, because it's an investment past money, right?
Yeah. I know, I'm the same way.
Yeah, you invest in people, you invest in situations. You know, I'm not a young guy. I'm up there now. And so it's a young man's game, but I have a full appreciation, and my one desire is to use my, as the comic books say, use your superpowers for good, right? So if I use my superpowers for good, more and more people will be able to play their instruments live and be able to make a living in this business, because that's really what it's about. Us being able to capture and record it, that's great. That's secondary though.
Boy, those are some really great tips, I got to say. I ask this of everybody that's on here, and this is episode 57, I think. And a lot of times the answers are somewhat similar, you know, as you would expect. Mm-hmm. But I've never had two examples like that, so that was great. Yeah. So thank you very much, Dave. Dynamite.
Hey, I quite enjoyed it. I appreciate it. Man, I appreciate you taking time yesterday, man. Thanks for joining us, and you know, I know we
got to
do something, man. We
got to
write a book.
Yeah, man. To find out more about Reftone monitors, go to reftone.com, reftone.com. To see the Everything Audio webcast, go to waves.com/everything-audio. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyointercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at EDMMR. He helps put this show together. Thank you very much, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab. Or go to bobbyointercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyointercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter or alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.